Welcome to the March edition of BBRO Beatcast. I'm Francesca Broom, your host and Knowledge Exchange Manager for BBRO. This month, we pick up on two of the discussions from the BeatTech 25 events. Firstly, we hear from Georgina Barrett about cover crops and timely destruction in order to reduce any green bridging. That should mean that fields are already clear and ready for drilling. If they're not, then we urge you to get them clear as soon as possible. George also talks about the BBRO Cover Crop Guide and our newly released publication for on-farm trials. Both are available from our website under publications. And from George, we'll then hear from Pam Chambers regarding weed control for 2025. But first, let's catch up with George.
Good morning, everyone. So today I'm just going to take you through some observations and thoughts about cover crops and cover crop destruction. So how many of you here grow or have something to do with cover crops? It's normally about 50% of the people that are active in their beet growing. Yeah, nice. I don't need to do the spiel on cover crops. They bring a whole host of benefits, nutrient holding, soil restructuring, reducing leaching and runoff. They have a lot of benefits, and I don't want to focus just on the negatives. I do accept they have a lot of good things that they do. However, we all know that they do bring a lot of challenges as well on the way, and thinking about how we manage them best to make sure that they don't compromise the subsequent beet crop is really important. So there's two things we can start off thinking about. One is nematodes and just thinking about nematode control. But some cover crop species, particularly your brassicas, can be very tasty for nematodes. They can help them reproduce and they can really exacerbate the problem if it's there. There are class one varieties that will prevent that and stop that, so they're a good option. But really, it's just a call to arms of if you don't know if you have BCN, it is worth testing and understanding if you have it present and just tailoring your cover crop selection to that. So that's something to think about when we get through the year, get into autumn. What can we think about right now, right this minute? What is the challenge? What do we need to think about? And that's the green bridge risk. We talk about it all the time. It's probably one of Mark's top 10 phrases. And that's thinking really about, firstly, are your different cover crop species hosting virus? But secondly, is it also tasty to aphids? Because you need the two together for it to be a risk. If something's high in virus level, but is not then tasty and the aphids aren't feeding on it to then feed on the sugar beet, it's not so much for a risk. So some of you will have seen this. This is our cover crop guide. A lot of the information is sort of widely available information, but we thought it'd be handy putting it all in one place. But the bit I want to draw your attention to are these two rows here. So we have one called virus yellows host risk. This is how much of the virus is in the plant, basically. We did test the three different viruses separately, so we understand which viruses the cover crops do or don't host. However, from a management perspective, that's not really that relevant. You can't do much about that. That information is not going to make much of a difference to you on farm. It's mainly you need to know, is it a risk or not? So we've simplified it, kept it into one row for you. But that's not the whole story. Obviously, the second part, as I just mentioned, is also understanding if the aphids like feeding on those cover crop species as well. So the team did also score the different cover crops for the amount of aphids that were on them as well. And it's obviously needing those two together that provides a risk. However, BBRO doesn't support, not support, or say any cover crop species are better than the other. What we want this information for is just to think about, firstly, selection and then timing of destruction. If you're maybe on a heavier soil type where travelling and getting on and destroying your cover crops is more challenging, think about avoiding some of the higher risk species that you might be able to get on farm. Some examples of that, red clover is a good one, or not a good one. That hosts a high level of virus. There's a lot of virus in the cover crop if it is infected, and it's very palatable for aphids as well. So one that is a bit more of a risk. Whereas next to it, we've got Phacelia. Obviously, Phacelia is a really popular cover crop, high biomass, quick growing. That has a high level of virus in it, but quite low for aphids. Obviously, not a very tasty plant. I've not chewed on Phacelia myself, but clearly it's not that palatable if you're an aphid. So, as I said, we're not saying do or don't grow anything, but hopefully that gives you some information out there when you're thinking about either timing of destruction now or thinking about your selection of mixes in the autumn. Coming back to the present, what we're thinking about now and thinking about that green bridging risk, I've got some demo pots at the front. What we've done here is we've got some here that are still green. So these have been left in the frost, and these give a really good example of your frost-tolerant species versus your non-frost-tolerant. That can be a good option because if you're struggling to get on and get good destruction, obviously the weather doing some of the job for you is always a win. So in the first pot, we've got crimson clover and buckwheat. As you can see, the frost has completely eliminated the buckwheat. We've got pretty much no buckwheat left. It's completely dead. But the clover's pretty much untouched. If anything, the buckwheat's disappeared and the clover's enjoying itself because there's no competition with the buckwheat. In this one, we've got a radish and rye mix. As you can see, the radish has actually been pretty much unaffected, a little bit of damage, and the rye has died back. And then finally, a real classic is vetch. Vetch is very frost susceptible. It doesn't need much frost at all to kill it off. So the vetch is gone, but our black oat is still very much alive. So just the weather alone can give you some benefit. And as I just highlighted, maybe thinking about frost susceptible species can be a good one if you're struggling to get timely destruction. Following on from that, I will touch on grazing separately, but if we're going to go down the chemical route, we've got three pots here. Again, the same mix is sprayed with glyphosate. In this case, they've actually done quite a good job, but I will caveat that with the fact that we use shop-bought glyphosate, which is always very effective. It's very well formulated, very concentrated. And they were put on the windowsill in the lab, which was very warm. They were supercharged to die, really, which is sort of the opposite of what I want you to take away from my messaging, which is glyphosate obviously works really slow at this time of year. Cover crop destruction, a good time to spray is often around Christmas. You want to give yourself sort of the 3 week time to die off before your 6 weeks before sugar beet drilling, which I'll come back to in a minute. So just thinking about glyphosate use, getting on early, making sure we're getting good dieback and really getting rid of that green bridge. Secondly to that as well, is just thinking about if you have clovers and things in your mix, 2,4-D can be very, very beneficial. So Kylio glyphosate 2,4-D can use together. However, we need a time machine really now because that has a 60-day interval before drilling. So we have to have used it on the 19th to be drilling by the 20th of March. So not something necessarily to think about this year, but in future years, if you've had problems with killing off certain species in your mix, particularly legumes, 2,4-D and that Kylio could be a good option as well to make sure we get good, effective dieback. This pot I've got on the end, this very lonely random pot at the end, this was the same as the radish and rye pots over there. It was also on the lab windowsill, like a lot of them were. And for context, in our lab, we have our different virus cultures. And in each virus culture, there's obviously a certain number of aphids that are feeding, reproducing the virus. But a limitation to that is you have to open the door to water them. And occasionally you get escapees. And obviously we do that on a certain rota, so we're not contaminating our different cultures, but it does mean sometimes some aphids get out. Obviously, normally there's not green matter in the lab. The lab team don't like plants in the lab, so I was given special permission for these to actually be allowed out. And we looked on the windowsill, and the radish on this one was absolutely teeming in aphids, absolutely covered in aphids. And it was a really good point of the fact that it only takes one or two aphids. You know, there won't have been a lot that escaped from that culture. It wouldn't have been many, might have even just been one. And within a week, plants were absolutely teeming in them. So it doesn't take much. It only needs one aphid to land onto your susceptible cover crops and you will have a problem. And again, if that's then got a lot of potentially got virus in it, you're building up a reservoir of virus infected aphids that will then potentially spread onto your sugar beet crop. Really good demonstration. Something to think about. Getting that timely destruction is really important. 6 weeks ahead of sugar beet drilling. I often get the question, some of the payment schemes, sort of SFIs and that, and very much specify that you can't destroy 6 weeks before any form of drilling. But if you're sort of aiming for 1st of March, you can get on. On to grazing. We don't profess to be grazing experts at BBRO. There's probably people in this audience that know a lot more about cover crop grazing than I do. But it's just something worth touching on. Two things, really. One is thinking about nitrate leaching and making the most of that. So we all know that cover crop grazing can be good because it's freeing up and cycling those nutrients really quickly. But conversely, that can also be challenging because obviously you're freeing them up if you get heavy rainfall events. All that great nutrition is being lost through the soil profile. So the NIX cover crop report that ADAS undertook shows that leaving 10 to 20% green cover reduces that nitrate leaching. So something worth considering. But again, green bridging risks are weighing up there as well, challenges there. The other good thing with leaving some green top does mean that you can get on, and if you do decide to spray off with glyphosate, you will get better, obviously, control and efficacy. You need some of that green top remaining. So on the grazing front, I completely get it. It can be a bit of a trade-off. You might leave your interval a bit closer to sugar beet drilling if you're wanting to feed the sheep and meet your weight gain targets. But certainly don't dismiss it and think, oh, they're eating it, so it'll be fine. There will still be aphids walking around on some of those crops that you've got in your grazing mix as well. So just something to consider and maybe get out there and have a bit of a look. The other thing that we've got, talking about nutrients, is nutrient release from cover crops. It's probably the question I get the most. If you said, what is the most common question you get relating to cover crops, George? It would be, how much can I adjust my nitrogen application based on what was in the cover crop or what the cover crop will release? Which is a fantastic question, which we don't have an answer to, being perfectly honest. There isn't an easy answer. You can sit, I've sat for many an hour reading the literature, trying to understand it more. Obviously, part of my job, I want to understand what research we can do, but there's no point duplicating what people have already done. And I can give you the really great advice of your cover crop mix can release nothing to 100 kilos of N for the subsequent crop. Quite a bit of a difference and probably not a risk you're going to want to take. So certainly something that's challenging. On the back of that, we are talking to people that have done some of that research to understand how we can advance it. Also how we can try and make it a bit more sugar beet specific. So we're off a bit of a foray into it this year. So we've got two cover crop trials in Norfolk to start with. They've been done by the farmer commercially. So they've gone through, drilled different replicated strips. We've been assessing the biomass, the soil, nitrogen levels, all those sorts of parameters. And we will follow that through to the sugar beet crop and see if there's any differences. And again, being completely transparent and seeing if it even makes any sense. So that data will be hopefully available. We'll update you as we go through in the year. And in those as well, we'll have the PlentySense nitrate sensors. So Alistair's got one on display in the crop watch area. So that measures nitrate at 10, 20 and 40 centimetres. So trying to understand that timing of release as well. So that'll be an interesting one to follow. Certainly won't give us all the answers, but might generate some good discussions. Which brings me on to sort of my final topic is there's so many questions on cover crops. We can talk about what species mix. We can talk about how they should go in and be established. We can talk about if we should put nutrition on them. We can talk about what soil type you're on. We can talk about timing and method of destruction. You could have a research organisation just looking at cover crops. So this is where we're interested to hear from you guys. We want to hear your experiences. What's working for you? You know, there's people that have been doing cover crops before they were cool, and it's just a day-to-day part of their farming rotation. We want to hear what's working for you and to also help with that and to help people that maybe are thinking about changing. Maybe you're going into cover crops for the first time or you want to try some different mixes. Doing some on-farm trials, talking to us about it, we can help you through that. We can help you do some data collection as well. So what we've done, and I'll talk about it in my main talk later, is we've produced an on-farm trials guide, which is in all of your folders. Just to give you a bit of a steer, if you're thinking about trying some different things on farm, sort of different ways to go about that, but also contacting us and we will help support you in that. And you can't really lose. It's going to be then tailored information to your own farm, your own system, your own equipment, and find out really what works for you.
And here we are, field clean, cultivation's finished, and we all wait patiently for a good weather window to get the drills rolling. But what other seed is lurking underneath the surface? Do you know the likely weed pressures in each of your fields? And have you thought about pre- and post-emergence herbicide use? Now we hear from weed specialist Pam Chambers of British Sugar with some pointers for 2025.
Welcome, everybody. And I'm talking about weed control. Everything you need to know in 15 minutes. So that's quite an impossible task, really. So the first thing, I think planning is absolute key. And we have got a little bit more complicated, I think, in some of the decisions we have to make. We have a choice now on smart varieties, conventional varieties. Some of us are renting in land. We don't always know what weed spectrum that we're going to be seeing. ALS resistance, that's occurring as well. And also sprayer capacity. It's nothing worse than those who are given a recommendation thinking the sprayer can get round in 7 days, and yet in reality it's going to be probably 10 to 14 days. So at this time of the year, I think it's really crucial that you actually sit down and have a look at what you're going to be doing. Discussing about whether you put a pre-em or on or not. The last few years, that's worked very well because we've had moist conditions when we've been drilling. And look at the costs as well. Do some budgeting. Look at the product availability. Do you do straights or do you do formulated mixes? And what is actually available to you to use as well? Variable crop emergence, that's not been an issue for us the last few seasons. Quite a sort of moist seed bed at drilling, and crop has come through fairly evenly, well, very evenly. But in some years, we can get a situation where it will take quite a while for us to get to a full crop cover. And this example here, we were seeing in April, that we'd got around 20,000 plants emerged of the sugar beet crop. And it wasn't until June, when we got some rain, that we got up to 82,000 plants. And the question often is, when you've got a low population, is should I actually be spending money on a herbicide or not? And it's very difficult to persuade yourself to put a herbicide on if you've only got 20,000 plants there. So my advice would be is look and see if the seed is viable, that it's not yet emerged. You can have a look with a hand lens, see if it's actually cracked. If it has, you then need to really think about, is that still viable? Because it might have imbibed some water and then just dried off and then becomes no longer going to germinate. So do a quick germination test. Ask for some help from BBRO or put some on a damp tissue paper in a warm environment. It doesn't take long to see if it's going to chit or not. We had a trial in this field, in this example, and we were seeing when the sugar beet were emerging, we'd got knotgrass emerging as well. Very difficult weed to control. And on the untreated plots in our trial in that field, when we come to June, the knotgrass hadn't had a herbicide. It was really big. We'd have never controlled it with a herbicide, and it was obviously going to compete with the crop for yield and also be a problem for harvest. So my key message here, if you've got variable crop emergence, the seed is still viable of the sugar beet, you start spraying. You might need to think about what mix you use, but you need to be putting something on to hold those weeds back so that you can keep on top of them. There's nothing worse than having an open canopy through here and letting those weeds keep growing. There are three key actives when we're talking about conventional chemistry: fenmedifam, metametron and ethafumisate. I always start with those, look at them and see what weeds they're going to be controlling, and then you think about what other weeds you can expect and add other actives in accordingly. For instance, clopyridin for volunteer potatoes or thistles, etc. So I look at those as the building blocks. And then there's factors impacting on herbicide activity. And that can be soil pH, soil structure, as we talked about here, moisture, etc. And so it's key. If you have an issue with pH, I've seen examples where we've got it's very acidic, you put herbicides on, and that can really hit the crop. Not the fault of the herbicide, it's the underlying conditions. Now, any of you in this room used Lenacil or Venzar last year and had any crop issues? Can you wave a hand? I have got one brave person. I think there's probably more than that. And I think that was not the fault of the active. We've had it for a long while. It can be very useful in a programme. But if you use Venzar or Lenacil in tank mix with other chemistry that can be quite hard on the crop, and you put it on just before a rainfall and you've got underlying conditions, that can cause issues. So I think we had got a bit complacent with that. So this chart here shows crop vigour, just to emphasise that when we put straight actives onto the sugar beet crop, so three applications of ethafumisate, three applications of metametron, or three of Venzar Lenacil, we can see the impact on that crop. Metametron, as in gold ticks, very, very kind, and that can be used at any crop growth stage. It's on all the metametron labels with an adjuvant, and it's very useful as a holding spray if you're in this sort of situation where you've not got a full crop or you've got some underlying issues. But as you can see there, triflusulfuron, methyl debut and Lenacil, the loss of vigour there, down to 60%. Clopyridin is not on there, but I'd expect that similar. You put all those three in a situation where the crop is stressed, then you get rainfall, heavy rainfall, you can have issues. So I think just be careful and think about what you're actually doing and applying to the crop. What about resistance? When I talk about resistance in sugar beet, we've not really talked about that much historically, because we've been very good at using tank mixes of different actives which have different modes of action. So if we have got resistance there, we don't see it. But across the rotation, so not just sugar beet, across the rotation, we've been using what we call ALS chemistry, mode of action group 2, on nearly all our crops, potatoes, cereals, oilseed rape, as with the Clearfield. They've all been used in this ALS chemistry for about 20 plus years. And so there has been instance of resistance there to weeds like poppies, chickweed, mayweed, etc. So when we go to using the smart varieties and Conviso 1, the Conviso 1 is consists of just two actives, which are Budav Action Group 2, both ALS. And so we then start to see some issues like we've got there. So it doesn't mean you stop growing smart varieties, but you need to rethink your programme and include perhaps some conventional chemistry there as well. We've been doing some tests with ADAS Boxworth. We're now in our second year of screens. The results will be through the end of this month. And along here, these are fields. And also, we include some susceptible strains that we know are susceptible to the ALS chemistry of poppy and chickweed. And what we see is with the susceptible ones, we've actually taken the seed, we've planted it, let it grow on, and then sprayed it with a full rate of Conviso 1. The susceptible ones, we get 100% death. There's nothing, you know, it's complete control. We also found that with one batch of seed from a farm. So it's not always resistance. Don't think you've always got resistance there. It can be other factors as well that are kicking in. But on these other ones, we were getting a reduced level of control. There was still some green matter there. The weeds were still hanging on. So that is a sign that we have got resistance starting in those situations. So that test, it costs quite a bit of money, around about £150. It takes several months to do. But the good news is that ADAS, BBRO and British Sugar, we're working together to do a rapid test, which will get results within 7 to 10 days. And that will help you make decisions prior to the sugar beet going in or during the season as well. I was talking to somebody earlier where you put Conviso on one on and sometimes you will get absolutely brilliant control of blackgrass. Another time you will be thinking, is it working? Is it not? I don't know. You could do a test, get that back within 7 to 10 days and know, that's fine, it's going to all go and be okay. Or do I need to put something like clethodim on to finish it off? So that is something to keep an eye on. That will be available very soon. Blackgrass control always comes up. And nothing really too much new there. When we're using conventional chemistry, we would say start off with ethyfumisate as a pre-emergence. That's where you're going to get your most activity from. Include some other actives in there as well to broaden the spectrum of the weeds that you want to control. Something like Metametron, or you can add in Quinmeric, that is useful as well. And then post-emergence, we tend to be relying on the clethodim to give control of the blackgrass. What has changed there is you've got a range of formulations available now. I think the main one we all relate to is Centurion Max, which is a 120-gram formulation. But we have others now which are 180 and 240. And some of those allow you to put a higher amount of clethodim onto the crop. And don't forget, in fodder beet for a number of years now, we've been able to apply a 2-litre rate of the 120 formulation. It's very, clethodim is very safe to sugar beet. It's unlike what you'd see in the oilseed rape crop. And so that, I think, is nothing else really to say about blackgrass. Moving on to fat hen, I won't ask the question, but I'm sure that all of you who are involved with weed control of sugar beet will have discussed or had issues with fat hen at some point. We had a trial up here at Bracebridge Heath a few years back where we had quite a high population of fat hen. And we looked at different mixes and combinations and we did manage to get 100% control. And I think the key messages there are is Metametron. If you're expecting fat hen, don't cut back on the amount of Metametron you apply. It may be you put it on pre-em or early post-em, build that amount of Metametron up. In our trial, we was putting 1 litre per hectare at each application for 3 timings. And then as you get to the later stages, if you've got some fat hen still surviving, then Fenmedifam and ethyfumisate and oil can be very effective. And again, keep those intervals tight if you're struggling. Don't spray, then think, oh yes, it's looking as if it's going to die. If you're thinking, is it or isn't it, you go back in. Keep the intervals tight. It's nothing worse than letting the weeds sort of start to recover, wax up, and then it'll be even more difficult to control them. As we said, 44 plants per metre squared in the untreated. You can't see it from here, but you may do in your little leaflets. That. So it's quite a lot of fat hen. We went on 2 litres of the 160 Fenmedifam, 0.3 of the ethyfumisate, litre of Metametron, 3 times, good intervals and we got control.
And more control of the crop is exactly what BBRO are aiming to provide you in 2025 as part of our Detail Delivers programme. You can access all of the publications mentioned via our website, and if you'd also like to click on the events tab, you can access the Beet Tech presentations. We will also be holding a spring beet chat, that's our growers online meeting, on March the 21st, a link to which will be issued shortly. Now, if you have pen and paper ready, we have the basis points for both February and March editions of BeetCast. February's reference number is CP/143057/24254/K, and March edition is CP143998/24254/K. Let's hope we can spring into March with a little bit of sunshine and a good start to the sugar beet year. Thank you very much for listening.